the witness list. And if you give us a an overview on the bill, and then also state that the 3012, the amendments are not reflected in the estimate.
Right. Okay, the overview of the bill is that it requires school district boards to acquire a firearm safety education program for children from kindergarten through grade 6, and then to develop on the local level such a program for children in the 7th through 12th grade. It has some description of the appropriate content for such courses and requires the public schools to implement the program to give instruction at least one class period per semester to all students except for those whose parents have requested that the child be excluded. I will mention that just a few minutes ago we received the -1 amendments, which you have copies of in your packets and which there are copies of on the back table for any of you folks that would like to see those, but they are not reflected in the SMS.
Mr. Pitzer.
Committee. I got two parts to my testimony here. One is written, one is not.
Could you identify yourself for our team?
Oh, directly, please. My name's Tim Pitzer. I'm the Oregon State Coordinator for the Eddie Eagle Gun Safety Program in Oregon and Vice President of the Oregon State Shooting Association. Address 2815 South Shore Drive, Albany, Oregon. And like I said, I have two parts here. And I offer my testimony in favor of HB 3012. I'm coordinator for Eddie Eagle Gun Safety Program. I'm not here to lobby for Eddie Eagle Program in particular to be used. However, the success of our program in Oregon showcases the effectiveness of teaching gun safety in the schools. Please let me begin by stating that gun control, political beliefs, etc., have nothing to do with gun safety as we teach it with the Eddie Eagle program. Now, the Eddie Eagle program is, like I say, K through 6, and we do not teach a child how to use a gun. We do not teach a child the guns are good or the guns are bad. What we do teach is that firearms are not toys. They are not to be played with. If they find a firearm, whether they are at home, at a friend's, in the park, or anywhere, they are to stop, don't touch, leave the area and tell an adult. This is a simple message, and it's the heart of the Eddie Eagle program. During the 30-minute class, they shout this message, they do the Eddie Eagle shuffle, and they have fun. Most important is that they remember, because remembering these words will get them out of harm's way in any potential dangerous situation they may find themselves in. We teach responsibility and discipline. We give the child a way to help themselves. When we are not present, when we are present, we protect them. When we are not, they need the tools to protect themselves. Eddie Eagle's message is a tool, and it's a simple tool, and it's a fun tool. And as we have seen right here in Oregon, it works. The popular news program, 60 Minutes, decided to test the effectiveness of the Eddie Eagle program. They prepared a room which contained an unloaded handgun. They sent in some children who had been through the Eddie Eagle program to see what they would do when they discovered a firearm. Not one of the kids touched it. Several stood on the other side of the room, obviously, so they would not be caught near it. And a couple of kids came out of the room to tell the adult, an adult, that there is a gun in the room. Then they sent in a group of kids who had not been through the Eddie Eagle program. As soon as they entered the room, several kids went straight to the handgun. They picked it up, and one actually pulled the trigger. This is a very dramatic demonstration as proof that our program works. Teaching gun safety in schools has the added benefit of raising the awareness of the parents at home. We send home a flyer entitled Parents Guide to Gun Safety, which is a copy included in your text there. And we send that home with each child to give to their parents. This flyer is meant to discuss a parent's responsibility, talking with a child, the differences between toy guns and real guns, and et cetera. We also have a brochure for schools. This is a reminder that every school should have a plan in effect to deal with the situation of finding a firearm on school property. The area should be secured, the police called, and only the police should move or attempt to clear the firearm. Again, a reminder and awareness. But presented in a comprehensive manner. Character education is a part of our school's curriculum, and the aim is to give our kids the tools to make the right choices to obtain their goals in life. And that's what Eddie Eagle does. As an unsupervised child has to rely on the skills they have learned to make the right choices. It's their responsibility to use those skills, and it's our responsibility to provide them. While firearms are prevalent in our society, there is no epidemic of some state of firearms injuries. Actually, government figures show a marked decline in firearms injuries, while firearms ownership is on the rise. I believe much of the decline can be attributed to the fact that the Eddie Eagle program has been taught to over 11 million children in the last 10 years. While this decline is certainly welcome news, it is no reason to lessen our efforts. And you'll note that the awards that Eddie Eagle program has had, has received the National School Public Relations Association, National Safety Council, American Legion Child Welfare Foundation, and numerous others. And as I said, Eddie Eagle is up to K through grade 6. For the middle and high school students in Albany there, we've been working on a program because Eddie Eagle is now in at least 96 cities in Oregon. And I say at least because I can't keep up with them all. They've been, some cities help other cities, and I don't always get word of them, but I've documented at least 96. But everywhere I go, and I was just last week down in Josephine County and started the Josephine County schools on this, Ed Eagle, I get asked about middle and high school. They're pretty much demanding a program for them. And so we started putting one together in Albany, and as we were doing that, we got word that McKenzie Wilson Hospital in Springfield, shortly after the Springfield shootings, they started through their emergency room manager, Tom Hanley, started putting together a program, and he's been teaching it in a couple of schools there. He's made a terrific start on the program. He's got a good way to present the information to them without grossing them out, as some organizations attempt to do. And it's the simple goals that he has there are to debunk the image created by the media that glamorizes gun violence. And he deals not only with a shooting, but what happens after a shooting, the remorse of the family, the consequences that come up, the things that a person has to do to recuperate from it. And get across the message that, like on TV, with a shooting, it's over right there. You don't deal with the aftermath. There is consequences afterwards. And knowing this, getting this into the kids' mind, helps them make their decisions better. And that's the second main goal, is motivating kids to make the right personal choices when confronted with a situation that involves firearms. And it's pretty much common sense. It's easily taught in a 30 to 40 minute time limit, and it can be, like I say, we've got the program just about completed. We have a script for a video written, a scenario, and Chambers Communication is offered to help us produce that. And we have the program just about all put together, and we would offer that to the state anywhere they that we could put it, and it would be free of charge. The name of that program is Keep Safe, and there's also testimony included with mine from Lynn Bohart. She's the executive director of McKenzie Willamette Foundation in favor.
So the school districts don't have to develop a program. You've got a program already.
Right. We've got to develop on board and ready, about ready to go.
Questions, Mr. Quinn? Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me how your program relates to the Josephine County schools? And was that a particular district you're working with, or was it the Grants Pass School District, or?
Yes, I just went down and the superintendent of Josephine County Schools called me, and I went down, presented the Ed Eagle program to them. The Josephine County Sheriff, John Lawson, was there, and he offered to teach the program to some of the schools, and the law enforcement gets involved a lot in teaching Eddie Eagle. And but there's 1,400 students to do by the end of the year, so it still wasn't, it was going to be hard to get them all. So I went down to Klamath Falls, the city police department, and in 10 minutes there showed him our program, and he offered to teach it to the schools that are inside the city limits. So we had a package put together, and it's going to be done by the end of the year.
Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you answered this question, and I missed it, on how many schools are already doing this.
Well, there's 95 cities that it's being taught in.
In Oregon?
Right. Or, excuse me, 96 cities, right. That I know of, and I know there's more than that. But,
I noticed in the endorsements that are attached to your testimony from a number of other states. Are there any states who mandate this?
I'm not sure. I haven't checked on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. In the cities that do have this program, are they taught by law enforcement, volunteers, who all are teaching?
There's probably 98% of it is, you know, a mix of the instructors in the schools themselves and the law enforcement. There are a few, like scout groups, Head Start programs, quite a few of them teaching it. Law enforcement really does, they depreciate the opportunity because it gives them a chance to interact with the kids and kids really pay attention when they come in.
Follow up.
Does Salem have the study for
No, it's in, the Kaiser has put on a couple of programs. Salem, no, not yet. Since Sherwood, Dayton, some surrounding Portland areas. Of course, Albany was the first place to institute it, and Albany Police Department's been real helpful in helping get it around, too.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Green and Wilma Wells.
Good afternoon, Sheriff Sansari and members of the committee. Since I've just read the amendments, which I believe we can live with, if I could offer a friendly amendment to that.
Offer away.
In line 3 of amendment number 1, each school district board is encouraged to implement, and on line 16, this shall work in, is encouraged to work with a local law enforcement agency.
So that sort of means like if you feel like it?
That sort of means like the legislature is encouraging you to work with these agencies to do gun control. And if those, if that is the case, then we could agree with. It's a good idea. It is a mandated curriculum. It's a little more difficult.
Question. Well, don't most of the school districts work with the law enforcement agencies currently?
Yes. They do. At least larger districts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many of our school districts now have gun safety programs?
Wilma, I need to ask you to identify yourself for the record.
I'm Wilma Wells with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi. How many of our school districts now have gun safety programs?
Chair, since Harry, Representative Starr, I cannot respond to that. I have no idea.
Thanks.
Further questions? Mr. Green.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. The Oregon School Boards Association always has problems with mandated curriculum within our K-12 school systems. We're currently working on Oregon's Educational Act of the 21st Century and attempting to get our kids up to those high standards, and we're spending a great deal of time, resources, and money in the classroom working towards those standards, and any time away from those core curriculum issues obviously detract from our kids reaching those standards. You know, I find the bill a little bit ironic. I'm a gun owner. I'm a responsible gun owner. I have a six-year-old daughter, and my guns are locked up. The ammunition is locked up in a separate place away from the guns. And that's what a responsible gun owner does. This bill doesn't get at responsible gun ownership. It's talking about irresponsible gun ownership. It's talking about the parents who leave the gun loaded, don't tell their kids not to touch it. And this is just telling schools, you need to step in and be the parent for somebody who's an irresponsible parent. And I don't think that's the role of our public schools. I also find it a little bit ironic that we passed a charter school bill, which we supported, that allows for exemptions from this very program. And I just believe that when you mandate a curriculum like this, it takes away from the real goal of our public schools. And to get to your question, Representative Starr, I believe the previous witness said that it's currently in 96 schools. I think he's talking about the Eddie Eagle program. If you talk about hunter safety in general, where the child or the juvenile has to get their hunter safety card in order to be a hunter in the state, I think we're looking at a larger number than just 96. I don't have that information right now, but I can get you that information beyond just the Eddie the Eagle program, but the hunter safety. In order for a juvenile within the state of Oregon to be a licensed hunter, they must pass that course as well. So I can get you that information to let you know how many school districts. But I do find this bill a little bit ironic, because what it does say is you schools are now going to become the parent for the irresponsible gun owners. And I don't think that's the role that the schools need to be taking on. We need to be taking on the role of making sure we have good citizens and we have a well-educated citizenship in the state of Oregon. And mandating a program like this doesn't ensure that. It is a good program. We encourage our school districts to adopt the Eddie the Eagle program for the K-3 and K-5 programs. But the Dash 1 say that if local law enforcement personnel ask us, we have to implement the program working with them. It goes on to say if local medical providers ask us, we have to implement the program. And if you're going to amend this, local medical provider, I think, would need to be defined, because I'm not quite sure what that means. You could ask a school district, and they could be approached by a variety of folks that believe themselves to be licensed medical providers, and we're not quite sure what that means to us. But we do oppose any mandated curriculum down in the schools on this program. We're working with the folks to make sure that the Eddie the Eagle program gets into our schools. You heard the previous witness, Mr. Pitzer, testify it's happening. It's not mandated, but it is happening. And for those school districts that have the time, the resources, and the ability to provide the program, they're doing that in cooperation with a variety of groups across the state.
On line 6 of the Dash 1s, it says that the program shall be based on programs approved and developed by national or state organizations with an interest in firearm safety for children. I don't know of any of those national organizations that only teach about irresponsible gun ownership, but they do teach about responsible gun ownership as well. So if we implement a program like that, the comment about only irresponsible gun ownership is going to be taught isn't exactly accurate, as long as we follow one of those programs.
Mr. Chair, maybe I misspoke or misunderstood. I don't believe those programs. I took the hunter safety course when I was in school, and that was offered by the Oregon Hunting Association. So I don't believe they're teaching irresponsible. What I meant was, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be taking the role, the public schools are going to be taking the role of the irresponsible parent who is not teaching their child. I believe if you're going to own a gun, whether it be a handgun, a long rifle, or a shotgun, you should have to teach your kids about that ownership and what it means, the dangers inherent with a firearm, and also the sport of using a firearm. Because if you have a firearm, it should be locked up. The ammunition should be stored separately. And I learned that one place, and that was from the National Rifle Association and my association in getting my hunter safety card, and also from my parents and my grandparents.
You seem to be willing to put schools in that position when we want to talk about sex education.
Well, Mr.
Chair, certainly that, I suppose, if you take it out to its logical end, there could be some deaths connected to that with some venereal disease, I suppose. But I suppose that education about guns and handling guns is just as important if we're going to put schools in that position to say we're not going to rely solely on parents to teach the proper use of this. Why can't we do that with guns?
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe if you'll go back when sex education was looking at being mandated in public schools, we were consistent in our position on that one as well, that is a local decision made by locally elected boards working with their parents, especially the issue of sex education. I do like the part in the dash ones that allow for opt-out. That's something we've done with all curriculum, because if a parent says, I don't want my child to participate, they should have that ability to say, I don't want my child to participate, and there shouldn't be any repercussions against the child. So I think we've been fairly consistent with our positions on state-mandated curriculum.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
I was curious about your comment that this would not be required of charter schools. I wonder, is that the chair's understanding of his bill, of your bill, that it would not be required of charter schools?
Exactly. But they could choose,
right,
to use it as well as
public schools.
But
it's your intent that it requires the public schools, but not charter schools.
Well, do you have a charter school bill yet?
Well, the bill that you've advocated for, I just want to make sure.
As you know, the charter school allows for charter schools to not be required to regular statutes that affect the traditional public schools. So you're correct.
Okay, I just want to make sure that you understood that.
I understand it. Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, Wilma indicated that she would be agreeable to a couple of friendly amendments, and that is to change shelves and courage. How about you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, that would be fine with us. And the Oregon School Boards Association, this bill's been around, I think I've worked with Mr. Harder for about 3 sessions on this particular issue. And when they were first introduced, our association sent out a variety of mailings to our membership saying, this program is available. We encourage you to use this program. And if you need this program, you can contact. And we were given names by the National Rifle Association and who to contact with regard to the Eddie the Eagle program, which is a great elementary program. I've seen the tape. I've seen the program. It's a great program. We've encouraged our boards to use that. The decision whether it will be in the class or not, we believe, still needs to be at the local level.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sterrett.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Sterrett, and I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Firearms Federation and the State Representative for Gun Owners of America. And I think I understand the intentions of this bill, and I understand how much work went into trying to craft it as carefully as possible, but I do have some concerns. I did want to respond to something that Mr. Green said about it teaching only the children of irresponsible parents. What it would do is also teach the children of parents who don't own guns, but whose children might stumble on them in someone else's house. So in that respect, I think it's very important. My only concern is that I think there's a great potential here for this to wind up being something we didn't anticipate it being. For example, I am not real thrilled about the idea of and having just gotten the Dash 1 amendments, correct me if I've misinterpreted this, but I'm not terribly thrilled about the idea of firearm safety being taught by law enforcement or medical providers. That might work real well in Eastern Oregon, but I don't think that the Portland Police Department would necessarily put together a program that I'd approve of. I wouldn't want Dr. Linda Irwin putting together a firearm safety program either. As for the definition of who can create the program, a national or state organization with an interest in firearm safety, well, that could be Gun Owners of America, but that could be Handgun Control Incorporated. And I'm just afraid that although as a firearms instructor and as a parent of a young child, I'm very, very sensitive to the idea that children should be taught this in some form, but I'm just concerned that this might wind up turning into something that we had never anticipated.
illustration?
I beg your pardon?
Illustration?
An illustration of how it could turn into something we didn't anticipate. Portland Police Department teaching firearm safety with a police chief who is vocally anti-gun. Charles Moose is, as you know, because he's been here testifying against civilian possession of firearms. The medical establishment, I don't understand what qualifies them to teach firearm safety. And I'm also not sure I understand the portion of the bill that says if they're contacted by local law enforcement personnel, and I'm not sure if that means that the program would be implemented only if the police ask them to, in which case I don't see it as a achieving what the intention is, which is to make sure that there's some safety training in all the schools. Sounds to me like this is a big if, and I may have misunderstood it, but I'd like to see the program that is going to be implemented very clearly defined so that I don't wind up with an anti-gun police organization teaching kids that every time they touch a gun, it's going to necessarily be a bad thing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we will bring this bill back when Mr. Harder is available to join us. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3012. And we will open the public hearing on House Bill 3017. Mr. Bass.
Harrison Ferry and members of the House Education Committee. For the record, I'm Roger Bassett, Commissioner of the Office of Community College Services and Job Training Partnership Act Administration. Joining with me today are several representatives of Mount Hood Community College and area school districts to give an example of how legislation could lead to a different relationship, hopefully a very productive one, between community colleges and area school districts in the delivery of the endorsement credential part of the Oregon Educational Act for the 21st century. Mr. Chair, I'll summarize very briefly my remarks since you have them in slowly arriving at your table in writing. I just wanted to note I have personally worked with community colleges since initial passage of the Oregon Educational Act to find ways, for the 21st century, to find ways in which community colleges and their resources could be supportive of the implementation of that act. During all of that time, we've looked for ways in which there could be bridges of various kinds between the community colleges and school districts, as opposed to suggesting that there ought to be a fuzzing of the line of responsibility. Originally, that was just a matrix that looked at ways in which we could help. That evolved into the proficiencies for entry into programs, the PREP standards, which are the professional technical equivalent of the PASS standards that you hear so much about, and which would ease the transition of high school students to community colleges and those kinds of programs. And then in this interim, the State Board of Education spent quite a bit of time talking about the idea of the endorsement credential and how that notion in the Act could, if made the responsibility of community colleges, if established as something that is in addition to high school completion, and if aligned to the one-year certificate programs already in the community college program inventory, then for which the objective is placement in initial jobs in career fields. If we could line all of those things up, then we would have a real opportunity for the capacity, the certificate vocational program, certificate capacity of community colleges to lend a helping hand to the success of the Oregon Educational Act. So when you, Mr. Chair, asked for ideas for how community colleges could help with the CAM, I was able to bring to you that work of the State Board of Education, which had been accepted and then set aside pending completion of the CAM last summer, but to bring it to you as an example of a policy framework that was already a matter of record, and I appreciate your interest and encourage the interest of others in the committee in this legislation. What I'd like to do is introduce, if there are questions of me, introduce President Joel Vella, who will share with you an example of how this legislation would be implemented, could be implemented, by, in this case, Mount Hood Community College, of which President Vella is the president, and with the help of some area school district folks who will come in order.
Welcome, Dr. Vella.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Vella, J-O-E-L-V-E-L-A. president of Mount Hood Community College in Gresham, Oregon. Mount Hood Community College, as you are well aware, has a strong, long legacy of some 33 years in operation, having been founded in the late 1960s. The foundation of the establishment of the community college system was a strong outreach effort to its local communities. In my 31, 32 months as president of the college, I have attempted to facilitate and foster that particular relationship, reaching out to the 8 school districts in our service area. The example which will be presented to you this afternoon exemplifies what I feel is a true partnership between the college and the 8 school districts, a partnership that reaches out to ensure and to assure that opportunities are extended to the children now enrolled in our K-12 system to facilitate the transition of those youngsters from K-12 to the community college and onto the place of work or onto a four-year institution. The information that you will be receiving from Michael Dewar, Vice President of Instruction and Community Outreach, is an example that has been worked out between the college and members of our K-12 sister institutions. We're proud of the relationship we have forged. We are excited about this particular opportunity, and we bring it to you in the best sense of the word, cooperation between colleges and our K-12 partners.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to give just a short snapshot of Michael Dewar, Vice President of Instructional Services at Mount Hood Community College, D-U-R-R-E-R. Just a snapshot of some of the programs that we have worked with the local high school districts ourselves. Over the years, we have worked with our high school districts with an internship with manufacturing technology, welding boot camp, microelectronics, and engineering CAD programs. So we have had experience working with our local high schools with regards to projects and training that would help high school students. At this time, I'd like to introduce Joe Dunlap, who is the Dean of Industrial Technology at Mount Hood, and Bill Lesh, who is the Regional Coordinator of the Multnomah Education Service District, and Jim Buck, who is the Assistant Superintendent of Gresham Bartle High School, and they'll be explaining the program to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Lesh, and I am the Regional Coordinator for the Mount Hood Regional Education Consortium, which is the connection between the 8 area high schools and the community college. I believe you received a handout that describes the program that we're going to address for you today, and I'd like to just go through that and hit some high points of it for you, and then we are available to answer some questions. First of all, we're targeting the endorsement area of engineering and industrial systems specifically because of the fact that it's a very high growth area in the state as well as in our region, and we felt that that led us to lots of opportunities for students regardless of where they went along the educational path. Secondly, it's one of the more difficult areas to do without involvement with industry and without partnering. So we have identified some key ways to get at the challenge of putting together that particular endorsement. In addition to that, it takes a considerable amount of work to refine what current curriculum exists to be able to make it match with what industry standards are calling for. And this project, as a pilot, is designed to do that. As one example of how you can use industry standards as a way to improve curriculum. Briefly, the participants would be area students that would be finishing up high school or have just finished up high school, industry partners, Mount Hood Community College, and community groups in the region that see this particular program as a benefit for involvement. We're looking at this as a concrete link between our secondary school system and the college with a very continuous curriculum starting at the high school level, carrying on through the community college, and on into associate or certificate programs.
Chairman Cesari and members of the committee, I'm Joe Dunlap, Dean of Industrial Technology at Mount Hood Community College. There are a number of key elements in this certificate of endorsement that make it a very flexible instrument for linking the community, the educational institutions, and industry within a particular region or county. First of all, it integrates the academic skills and the knowledge necessary to meet industry standards and practices. And those standards and practices would be identified through a needs assessment working with industry. Further, the testing of students that would graduate from this type of a program would be done through a third-party independent certification process. Also, it would utilize subject matter experts from industry to assist in the development of curriculum and the delivery of that curriculum. Further, we believe there is significant opportunity between the high schools, the community college, and industry for articulation beyond this particular program. Now, you may ask yourself, well, why would a community college be suited for the delivery of a certificate of endorsement? And I would like to give you an example as it relates to Mount Hood in terms of their particular programs. We believe that Mount Hood Community College is ideally suited to deliver a certificate of endorsement in cooperation with the high schools in the area. First of all, the teaching staff at the community college that would be involved in the industrial and engineering systems area all has industry experience. Further, we have certificate programs in such areas as welding technology, mechanical engineering, architectural engineering, welding, and AutoCAD and MasterCAM. We offer associate's degrees in many of those areas, including machine tool technology, engineering technology, and we offer a specialized trade and industry technology that's geared towards industry. It was mentioned about the Boeing Tech Prep program, and Mount Hood developed that particular program in conjunction with the Boeing Corporation. We also provide customized training to the Leatherman Tool Company, the Cascade Corporation, LSI, Fujitsu, and Photomask, and many others. In terms of the cost of this program, it's a pilot project, and it encompasses three specific areas. First of all is personnel, it also includes equipment, and it also includes operations over a two-year period of time. We have said that quality would be the bottom line in this particular project because it is a pilot project. And most importantly, it's in an area in which no single entity could deliver it by itself because of the cost and complexity. Hence, the cooperation and the development of these relationships with the high school, the community, and industry. In summary, I'd just like to say that this project would be available to all schools within the Mount Hood district. It also develops greater ties with industry that they will assist in the development and the delivery of this particular project. And as I had mentioned, it serves populations that do not possess the assets to conduct an engineering and industrial endorsement unto themselves. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes my portion.
Chairman Cesari, members of the committee, I'm Jim Buck from Gresham-Barlow School District. I'm representing actually 3,600 high school students in my district, and I'm here as an enthusiastic advocate for House Bill 3017. And I think I'm going to borrow a page from K-12 Education, which says good teaching uses effective mnemonics. I just want to spend a sentence or two on three words: process, partnership, and performance. This particular bill envisions a process that would actually encourage and offer incentive for school districts to continue developing CAM requirements. The most important thing to us is in that development that you better design and articulate courses with business and collegiate partners to form a seamless transition for students in the school to work pathway. So we think that process offers an example for how we can look at development in other CAM strands and how we can effectively partner with the college and with the business community. I want to also talk about partnership, because we have not heard in our school districts enough from the voice of industry and what those expectations are for students leaving school, whether it's the K-12 or the collegiate, in terms of meeting the expectations and standards that they have. This particular bill provides a vehicle for that voice to be heard and incorporated. You know, businesses really don't have the time to talk with each school staff, each school district. But this is a way of hearing those voices together in this consortium or partnership. The third part is, the third word is performance for students. And obviously we're concerned about making sure that students reach particular standards that will make them employable and ensure their success in future education experiences. The concern we hear from parents is that we don't want students, at least in high school, to be narrowing their options to, if we could use the analogy of a room key as they proceed down a hallway. Rather, we want to build the capacity and actually give them a pass key so they're able to go into many different rooms. We see this as helping with that kind of progression. It gives them the options to go forward. So I think it can be a pilot and a model for how we proceed and capture those students who are looking for greater relevance in their high school and collegiate experience. It ties to goals, specific goals, and a clear occupational course that right now may be unclear to them. Thank you.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Chair Sinceri. I like the concept of this, but I'm kind of experiencing sticker shock here with the $2 million price tag. Can you address some of the funding things on the last page? It looks like you've got four faculty at about $70,000 apiece. The average K-12 faculty salary is $41,000, so I'm wondering about the $70,000. Can you explain that?
Chairman Sinceri, Representative Close. Those numbers include fringe, which is at 39%. So there's 39% added onto the salary to include fringe for those individuals. And that's why if you look at $70,000 unto itself, yes, that would be a hefty salary, but it includes the fringe cost also.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask any one of you and whoever would like to respond. With this program and with another federal program that's soon to become a state program, the Workforce Initiative Act, I notice a common thread in all of this, and it seems to be an acceleration into the workforce, not only from high schoolers here and those in early secondary education, but am I just seeing things, or do I notice an increased emphasis on accelerating or propelling students into the workforce as quickly as possible? I don't want to get too far-ranging, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, I don't think the intention is necessarily to propel them. It is, if they choose that path, to better prepare them to be able to make that connection. We're not looking at decreasing the amount of time that's invested. We're looking at how is the curriculum experience going to be different than it's been done in the past, so it better connects to what those industry standards are, so there isn't a gap between the student that leaves our educational programs and the individual that's needed in those various organizations.
Well, I might just follow up, and is there plenty of room for the student who is not interested in any of this to continue a liberal arts path? No pressure to get involved in things like this?
If you would just identify yourself for the tape, question, I appreciate that.
My name is Bill Lash, Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson. There are multiple career paths that students can choose within our existing structure. This just happens to be one endorsement that has a lot of technical requirements to it for its success, and therefore that's why we're highlighting it as a regional effort, because of the fact that it's very difficult to do in a solo way within a region.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments, because we're talking a seamless educational system.
And we were often saying K through 12, and it might be kind of nice if you say P through 16 just for me. But also, on your resource, could you tell me what is non-destructive testing? Is? You don't have termites or...
Joe Dunlap, Mount Hood Community College. Chairman Cesari, Representative Winters. Non-destructive testing is a portion of the process of quality control in the metals manufacturing industry. For example, it's a method of testing metals to determine whether there are imperfections such as cracks or other deformities, and it is used, the types of systems that are used to test that are things such as the eddy current system, ultrasound, dye penetrant, and there are others. So it's a way of testing a fabricated part to determine its integrity and the quality.
So my welding son is probably back
to yes, I believe at some point he would in his educational process. Yeah.
Other questions? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, if I might, please. If I understood your testimony, again, this can go to anyone correctly, this is a program that would be provided for students somewhere between the CAM and an AA. In other words, the kids that maybe don't have the skills to proceed along and receive an Associate of Arts degree.
Bill Lesh, Mount Hood Regional Education Concern. Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson. This is designed for students who would be at the tail end of their CAM experience in high school or have already graduated from high school and be involved in a next step at the community college level. Could very well be a part of an associate degree program when it becomes a part of that at the college level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My other question is, and I tried to sit here to figure out how to say this without being crass, and I haven't come up with a good way. If my thought processes are correct, you can go ahead and do this anyway. What you really are here for is the money to finance the program at Mount Hood.
Joe Dunlap, Mount Hood Community College. The issue is a question of capacity and the ability to dedicate the people and the resources to develop a program. And if quality is the bottom line, then we believe that you need to dedicate those people to the development of this pilot project. If it's something that is developed ad hoc over a period of time, it will take an extreme amount of time, and it may or may not be the project that you want it to be. This particular project, we are here to describe to yourself a concept as to how the certificate of endorsement could be put in place. We gave you a price tag with that in terms of the development and delivery costs over a two-year period of time.
Actually, presently you're not providing CAM endorsements. You have 2+2 programs and that sort of thing where there's a partnership and a cooperation, but you're not actually lending yourself to the CAM program that we're trying to work towards. So this is it's an entirely new thing. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chair Cesari, and I wanted to follow, I think, a little on Representative Hobson's questions, but before that, could you tell me or distinguish for me what is going to be the difference between this and Associate of Science in metalwork?
Joe Dunlap, Mount Hood. This particular program is not necessarily delivered by community college instructors. Further, it's a one-year program. It's not a two-year program, such as an associate's degree.
I follow. Then there is currently no credit available for this program. That is, you do not have any... i.e., you know, 121 or 5.621 or whatever the appropriate.
Joe Dunlap, Chairman Cesari, and Representative Jensen. Those courses for this particular certificate program have not been developed.
Okay.
This program would be developed in conjunction with industry, and we would hope that it would allow for advanced placement within the associate's degree program.
One follow-up on that line then. What's the, or is there a plan to take some of the students who might go through a program like this through an Associate of Science or potentially Associate of Art degree?
Again, Joe Dunlap, Representative Cesari, and Representative Jensen. We would ideally like to see many of those students articulate into an associate's degree program at the community college. However, what we have discovered throughout Oregon is that many students, once they obtain some basic skills, move on into industry without obtaining that associate's degree. And if you look at the demand within the metals industry and the amount of graduates produced by Oregon community colleges in metalworking skills, there is a considerable gap, and this provides a bridging program for that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably a little question about that, but we'd get involved in material not necessarily germane to the committee here. If I can come back, though, to Representative Hobson's question that she didn't want to be crass about. It kind of sounds like that we'd like to have the state fund a pilot program, but that Mount Hood Community College doesn't want to do a pilot program.
Joe Dunlap, Mount Hood, Chairman Cesari, and Representative Jensen. Mount Hood would love to do it. It's a question of having the resources to do it. A considerable portion of the cost involves equipment. There's a considerable amount relating to personnel dedicated to the development of the project. We would love to have this project, but it's not something that we currently have the resources to devote to.
And Representative Jensen, just a comment on that, too. The hope is that this will show itself successful enough that in the next session we'll see this spread to the other community colleges.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't, and that wasn't the intention of my question. Maybe we're far enough on that.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Chair Cesari, members of the committee, just wrapping again, Roger Bassett from the Office of Community College Services. To the question of authority, there are a few limits on the things community colleges could do and will eventually do in serving populations like this, and we do have 2+2 programs and so on in place. But what we're attempting to respond to here is a very, very well-defined debate about how to implement the Oregon Educational Act of the 21st century, a similarly and not as well defined yet requirement for achievement of a certificate of advanced mastery, which we believe is the proper purview of school districts and high schools. What I need for you to do is visualize community colleges with some program capacity here walking up to that debate, not wanting to tilt it in one fashion or another and not wanting to become high schools, but having programs currently serving adults, which with some investment could be adapted and could become very real to-work opportunities for that population of high school students who plan to go to work, either on their way to getting the money for college or as an alternative. It is the result of a search on our part for those things that community colleges could do to help accelerate the implementation of the Act. So it is in that spirit that we bring to you identifiable connection, just the latest in our search for identifiable connections that is compatible with the Certificate of Advanced Mastery as a high school requirement and which has as its objective entry into work as a real learning framework. So we appreciate that the interest of the committee and pledge ourselves to make this legislation work in a fashion that Mount Hood has demonstrated today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Was there any, what was the reason behind selecting welding or tool and die making in that particular market?
Chair Sinceri, Representative Winters, that was the choice of the Mount Hood collaboration as they looked at their employment base and considered the strength of the college, the general structure of CAM endorsements, the interest of their industry, and what would they propose. I would expect under full implementation of this legislation that you would have 12 to 15 similar programs offered depending on the employment market of a particular area and the strength of a particular community college.
Representative Forsyth.
Are you aware, excuse me, are you aware of the Save and Skill Centers program? Does this mesh with that, or does it compete with it?
Chair Sinceri, Representative Moore said it does mesh with that. This provides a little sharper distinction and makes much of the one piece of the CAM that we think we could provide without interfering with the implementation of the overall act, that being the endorsement credential. So it brings that piece into sharper relief, and Sabin does, but it is a very similar pattern of resources, and that kind of collaboration would make this act, this piece of legislation, much easier to implement.
I think I'd just add a comment to that and say that if we had more skill centers throughout the state, this may be less necessary, but the community colleges are almost naturally equipped to be able to take that position where there are no skill centers.
They were in front of us a couple of weeks ago with the proposal to expand that program through community colleges around the state. So, again, does this compete with the funding that they're asking for? Or?
Chair Sinceri, Representative Morissette, that proposal is actually not designed for implementation through community colleges. That is a proposal for creating expanded professional technical capacity regionally through a collaboration among community colleges, school districts, employers, and others. So it is a similar capacity. I'm going to reach a little bit here, but if that legislation passed and that funding was available and the same players who just appeared before you chose to invest in the creation of this endorsement credential, then I think you would have the connection that we're talking about. But it is our reason before you today to talk very specifically about what community colleges can help do to make a success of the Certificate of Advanced Mastery.
Okay, I'm going to move us into a work session on House Bill 3017. And this bill is subsequently referred to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I move that we pass Bill 3017 with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, Representative Winters moves House Bill 3017 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Ways and Means. Is there a discussion? Clerk will call the roll. Oh, I'm sorry. I see you raise your hand, Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As much as it dismays me, I'm going to speak against this bill for a number of reasons. First, I think the ability to do it, if I'm understanding correctly, is already within the institution and the organization. Again, to follow up on my crass statement, I think that the wonderful people who are proposing this are here for $2 million. And if $2 million were readily available, I would certainly think that was going to a good cause. But even more than the money, I'm very concerned when we don't have the CAM really identified, delineated, much less implemented, that we're looking at putting in another certificate, and certificate of endorsement. And I'm also concerned on a third point, and that is the fact I do represent a rural area. I represent two community colleges, either one of which would give their eye teeth to have any of the programs that are already listed that Mount Hood currently has, much less adding on another one. And I realize that's easy for me to say, being out in the rural areas. But if the advantage and the need are related to the industry within
the area and the needs that are there, I think there should be maybe more industry stepping up to the plate to contribute to solving this need for training. So I will be opposed to this bill.
Representative Morissette.
Well, I'll support the bill. I'm going to do my homework, though, and before it comes to the floor of the House, and take a good look at the Saban model as opposed to this to see if there is conflict. But overall, I think it's a good program.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support the bill, too. Though I think Representative Hobson has some very good points and points that I'm concerned about. I'm not concerned about its conflict with the Saban Skill Center or that aspect, because I think there's a distinct difference between what we do at the community college and what is done at the high school level at Saban and other skill centers like that that might appear. And a different audience that may be appealed to at Mount Hood Community College in this program, with some people perhaps into, heaven forbid, 40, 45, 50 years old coming back to school to take advantage of this opportunity. So I think in that respect, you know, it's worthy a program. You don't see it competing as such. I think there is an issue that Ways and Means must look at, and that is whether we have, you know, if we've got $2 million, which of the programs are we going to put it in, and which are we going to get the best bang for our buck on? And I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, whether that should be a discussion that we're having or whether that should be a discussion that Ways and Means is having. So while I'll support it here today, I do have to advise that that there is a chance that I might take a different position as we get further down the line with it on the floor.
Thank you. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Beck.
Representative Trump.
Aye.
Representative Hoffman.
No.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Knox.
Aye.
Representative Morissette.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Wilson?
Aye.
Representative
Winchell?
Aye.
Representative
Strong?
Aye.
Chair?
Aye. Both aye. Measure stopped. And we'll close work session on 3017. And we will open the public hearing. House Bill 2828. Representative Croft. Have you got some folks you're going to bring up with you?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the two gentlemen sitting next to me are friends of mine. To my left is Harry Carter, constituent and business owner from Lebanon. And to my right is a man I have known for a great many years who taught me in school and has undoubtedly many interesting stories to share with you all about me, and I hope that he keeps those to a minimum today. This is Walter Carlson. A great friend and a great, I call him coach because he was my coach. And I will always refer to him as that.
Representative Croft, let me just say, Dr. Lace, we'll get to you just as quickly as we possibly can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. For the record, my name is State Representative Jeff Krupp, District 37. And again, I have the great privilege of appearing before your committee. It seems I'm in front of you a lot these days, more so than I think some of my own committees. I normally don't prepare written testimony, but I have a lot of things to say about this particular issue, and so I thought it would be better if I would allow you something to follow along with. I'm here to talk today about the Classroom Accountability Act, as I call it, House Bill 2828. The Classroom Accountability Act will ensure the safety of our children and teachers in the classroom. provides teachers and schools with the tools they need to effectively hold students accountable for their actions while protecting others from harmful behavior. I've introduced this legislation as a result of personal experiences over the years teaching fire prevention to third and fourth graders and talking to students, parents, teachers, and administrators. HB 2828 provides teachers and administrators and school district employees with civil immunity from lawsuits when a written and adopted disciplinary policy is administered. Current state law has resulted in widely varied and some ineffective disciplinary policies as a defensive measure against lawsuit. For example, a relative of mine teaches seventh grade here in Oregon, and with much frustration she recounted to me the detention policy at her school. If a teacher wants to put a child in detention at this particular school, they must first call the offending student's parents, ask permission for detention, and then schedule the detention around the child's schedule. Sometimes this isn't accomplished for days. And so much for the concept of swift accountability. This bill is necessary because, sadly, the continuing breakdown of the family and the general moral decay of society has resulted in some children not being taught the fundamental concept of respect for authority and behavioral accountability. These children exhibit behavior that puts other children and teachers at risk of physical violence, mental distress from intimidation, and other harmful conduct. A recent national study found that the disruptive classroom behavior has increased in Oregon from 37% in 1991 to 57% in 1994, a space of 3 years. A 1987 survey by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services found that a third of 8th and 10th graders say they've been threatened with some sort of violence at school. A report by the National School Safety Center found that almost 300,000 students are attacked every month. 2 million are victims of theft. Approximately 5,200 secondary teachers are physically attacked at school in a month's time, while 6,000 per month report extortion or robberies against them. Now contrast this with the biggest discipline problems of 1940, which were talking out of turn, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, cutting in line, dress code violations, and littering. 50 years later, in 1990, U.S. News and World Report reported that the biggest disciplinary problems are drug abuse, alcohol abuse, pregnancy, suicide, rape, robbery, and assault. Clearly, there's a serious problem. The unruly and dangerous behavior prevalent in today's classrooms must be stopped. The Classroom Accountability Act will help children who exhibit these types of behavior at an early age to understand that there are consequences for their actions. It will help curb unacceptable behavior before a child reaches an age at which behavior modification becomes almost impossible. Children today often exhibit a lack of respect for authority. I personally witnessed this with nieces and nephews and students that I have taught. This attitude leads to disobedience and disruptive, sometimes dangerous behavior. If we don't clarify the proper relationship between children and parents or teachers by establishing authority now, we will continue to produce generations of children who are unable to control their emotions and behaviors later in life. Discipline for success should be our motto. Personal self-discipline is the basis of our successfully reaching our goals. Self-discipline is an outgrowth of personal responsibility. We learn personal responsibility in an early age by understanding there are limits to our behavior. Some actions are acceptable, some are not. We understand the limits by being disciplined appropriately by those in authority over us. Discipline must be swift, tough but fair, and administered with love, and always with the best interests of the child in mind. And I might add, a discipline also directly relates to classroom size. If a classroom is orderly, positive education happens. If kids control classrooms, the positive education stops. Teachers can effectively teach more children if everyone behaves. This bill will ensure a safe, secure learning environment for our children, not only in the classroom, but in the schoolyard and on the bus, while not diminishing the rights of parents. It establishes a standard of behavior in the early stages of the child's development that positively benefits him throughout his or her life. Classroom Accountability Act makes physical work and corporal punishments allowable again, i.e. spanking, push-ups, cafeteria, cleanup, etc. Only if a local school district working together with parents decides to adopt them as part of their disciplinary policy. Corporal punishment is not mandatory. School district may or may not choose to adopt this as part of their overall discipline strategy. If they do, parents must individually approve of its use for their child. Parental rights must always be protected. There are clearly defined guidelines a district must follow if they find it necessary to administer corporal punishment to protect the child and the individuals holding the child accountable. I've received many letters, phone calls, emails, and faxes both in support and in opposition to the reinstatement of corporal punishment in our state. I've included a few of those for your consideration. You'll have them there also with my testimony. I realize that this is certainly a controversial proposition. However, I feel that we should have a healthy debate on these issues. I believe we all agree that discipline is needed. However, we may disagree on the methods of discipline. Depending on how and whom you ask the question of, Oregonians approve of corporal punishment in schools 70% to 30%, or disapprove by a similar margin. Clearly, there's a divided consensus with Oregonians on this issue. 29 states currently allow forms of corporal punishment, while 21 states ban it. There are several countries that also ban the practice. In 1979, Sweden banned all corporal punishment ostensibly to reduce child abuse. Since that time, a recent study showed that child abuse has increased 489% from 1981 to 1994 for one child abuse statistic, and a 672% increase in assaults by minors against minors for the same time period. This same study concluded that there was no sound evidence that corporal punishment was ineffective, nor that it was associated with child aggression. It went on to further suggest, and this is interesting, and I quote, "It is even possible that mild corporal punishment may play an important role in preventing escalation to abuse for some parents." In Oregon, it's interesting to note that since we've banned corporal punishment in schools, we've had two school shootings, the first of which, unfortunately, was in a school district that I represent in Sweet Home, and disruptive behavior is clearly on the rise. Today, you will hear from various individuals who have come to testify to the seriousness of this problem in support of this. I'd also like to make it clear that I believe some children can learn from corporal punishment, while for others it may be detrimental because of their home life or learning disabilities. That is why parental involvement is so vital to a successful discipline policy. Administrators must also make a judgment call on the appropriateness of using corporal punishment on some students. There will no doubt be others who will testify against this proposal, and they will cite studies, opinions, statistics to enhance their argument. The bottom line, however, is that you have to do what works. Corporal punishment works very well when administered appropriately without anger, whether at home or school. And I know, for I am a recipient of corporal punishment at home and at school, and I don't think I've turned out too badly, although there are those who would disagree with that statement. I suspect some of you, dear colleagues, have also been the recipient of such actions over the years. So have millions of Americans down through the years. If it is so damaging to a child when administered appropriately, then why haven't today's claims of detrimental effects been evident since the beginning of our country? In my opinion, it has only been since the societal elitists have promoted their agenda of social engineering in our schools, coupled with societal decay, that we have seen inappropriate and dangerous behavioral increases. To be clear, let's not confuse discipline with child beating. Spanking, administered with love and without anger, is not assault, as some would suggest. It is, however, a positive reminder to a child that there are consequences to one's behavior. Discipline is defined as training that corrects, molds, or perfects the mental faculties or moral character. Spanking is an age-old form of discipline. Life these days is challenging, to say the least. We must not bring children up in an environment where they are not held accountable for their behaviors as students, and then expect them to automatically know what is acceptable and what isn't as adults. This philosophy only sets children up for failure once they experience the harsh and sometimes unfair realities of life as an adult. Please consider joining me in helping to create a safer, more productive learning environment for our children at school. This concludes my prepared remarks. I'd be happy to take any questions at this time.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a observation to begin with, that certainly I have no question with your I think basic hypothesis that discipline is, or order in the classroom, is a necessary ingredient of education. A former professor of mine who Representative Marcet would know, Monsignor Hunthausen, said that 75% of being a good teacher is being able to maintain order in the classroom. And I certainly would concur with that, and I do appreciate that that is the intention, I think, of the bill that you're bringing for us here. I might have, however, having said that and recognizing that, some questions about the bill, if this is the appropriate time. And I'm wondering about the issue of equal protection under the law. Specifically that no corporal punishment can be administered unless the parent or legal guardian has given consent, if I read the bill correctly. Some children will have had that consent given, some will not, and therefore a differential type of treatment, potentially for the same behavior.
Mr. Chair and Representative Jensen, that's an excellent question. A question that was brought up also at the time we have met with various stakeholders in this issue, and we've asked legislative counsel for their opinion of that, and their opinion essentially was that that would not be a problem.
I know there's some other questions.
Any more stuff? Well, I have a series of questions, but I'll limit it at the present time. You started by giving an example of problems with the detention schedule. Now, tell me what you mean by detention, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morris said, I simply was recounting a story that a relative of mine reiterated to me when she wanted to put a child in detention for disciplinary reasons. Is certainly able to do so, but has to follow a prescribed manner for achieving that. That left her very frustrated in that it was not timely and sometimes could not be done right away and had to take a number of days at times to accomplish that goal. She felt it was an ineffective form of discipline because by the time the child had to serve detention, she had forgotten what it was about and the child had forgotten what it was about, and it really didn't mean anything.
Was that in a public school?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette, yes, that's correct. Public school in Lane County.
That's interesting. We have had in our school district, and I have been involved in detention rooms where kids are put in detention. In fact, it's at Springfield High School. I spent time during one of my periods monitoring that room, and when kids were not able to function in a class, it was in a fairly large study hall setting, and they were not to bring any, they were to bring their homework and their books, and it was to maintain complete silence, and it was very effective. I don't understand. Unless that particular school district had a particular policy that you had to check with the parents first, because this was not my experience,
And I know in the middle school and even in the elementary school, detention is effective. Now, this is not an argumentative question. I was just kind of curious. I do agree with almost everything that you have in this bill. I have some problems with the corporal punishment. I, as a classroom teacher for almost 30 years, again, feel like, as my colleague stated, that order in the classroom is absolutely necessary. You must maintain order. I do believe there are a number of ways, very effective ways of doing that, and as we continue this discussion through this bill, I'll raise some more of these questions.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chair, if we could hold any more questions, the hour is getting late, and these two gentlemen might have driven a considerable distance, and I know Dr. Lacey would like to speak also, and so proceed. Please, Harry.
Yes, my name is Harry Carter. I live down in Lebanon. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, first I want to thank Jeff for having the courage enough to present this bill. Secondly, I'd like to say that when I heard about the bill, I thought, you know, I think this is a real good idea, and I went back to my own personal experiences when I was growing up. One of the things that I learned was that that little squat on the rear is a great memory enhancement tool that worked really well for me. I was one of those very energetic children. And I did take several, I'm not going to go into how many, but several trips down to the principal's office for behavior that was not suitable for the classroom. One of the things I'd like to say and underline is that I never made that trip to the principal's office twice for the same thing. Now, one of the things I do want to cover, I'm very much against child abuse. I have no qualms about that whatsoever. However, in my mind, there's a major difference between child abuse and discipline. As Jeff said, I'm sure several of you sitting up there have experienced the ruler across the backside, and I don't see that any of you have become failures. It happened to me, and I, to this day, due to a situation that arose when I was a young lad of about 12 or 13, having lied to my father, and we made a trip to the Belt, I can't lie to anybody to this day. And I will tell you that I'm a car salesman. I know you're going to get a chuckle out of that. I'm supposed to lie for a living, but that isn't fact. The truth of it is, children respect discipline, whether it's administered at home or at school or wherever. And I do firmly believe that that discipline molds these children into better adults, as Jeff said. And I know he's a lot more eloquent than I am. I tend to ramble. But I would like to urge your serious consideration of this bill, because I think it's a necessary, fundamental thing in our society of today. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and rest of the representatives, when I used to start a class in the morning, first thing I did...
I need to have you identify yourself for the committee.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. My name is Walter Carlson. I was a teacher in four different school districts. I stayed 1 year in Powers and moved to Myrtle Point. And then left Myrtle Point area after 2 years, come up into the valley, and would have gone to Central Inn right away, but the position didn't open, so I went up to Sweet Home for a year, and then it opened, and I stayed 23 and a half years at Central Inn. I taught English and literature. And I've been through a lot of places. I've done a lot of work. I've skipped bells at the Drake Hotel in Chicago. I worked as in charge of credit collection in Presbyterian St. Luke's Hospital. Had to deal with people. First thing I learned is you have a shouter, get him into a room where you can quiet them down and you can talk to them. Not when they got an audience. You have to do the same with students. And there were several other places. I worked at the Mercantile Exchange and watched people rip their coats off over $14,000 items. Excitement, so even as adults, they get pretty worked up. The fines were rather heavy. But then again, I come to teaching in the classroom, and I ran into some problems that I couldn't believe existed, where principals gave a man credit with 2 years' experience for 6 years. The person told me that this person was the best teacher in the district. I thought, Walter, you've made a mistake. Well, it came out, and the fellow that retired at Powers, Oregon, Archie Flood, happened to take that class on a Friday one day of the best teacher in the district. And he found out why he was the best teacher. The students asked, "Are you going to take our grades for the week?" And oh, he said, "Is that what you do?" "Yes, we just read our grades off." "Well, when do you hand the papers in?" "We never hand them in. We correct them ourselves and get our grades." And I'm telling you, that was an awakening for me, and it was an awakening for Archie. The bad thing about it was Archie's father-in-law was on the school board, principal, and the teacher left. This man never corrected a paper. No wonder the kids all got A's and B's. Kids are not foolish. They understand if you neglect your duties. The other school districts were fine, and Central Inn was fine. You're dealing somewhat with the area that's more reserved at that time. But I wanted to start every class with, I'd walk through the door, "Good morning, class," and they would say good morning to me back. And it so happens that one day I forgot. I started taking roll, and I knew something was wrong. And I looked up and I said, "What's the problem?" "You forgot something." You know, and I don't know if you people realize it. When you say good morning to somebody, I usually myself, when I say it, I feel good if I say good morning. And that's my belief with the students too, and I get good results from it. Then we're going to, and Charles Vaughn, who was principal a few years ago at Sunset, at South Eugene, and a guy named Gene Heinley that's over at Springfield, I worked with him too, and he also saw these different ideas that I had. Mine is from personal experience. The first one, I'm going to talk about discipline, where you spank. And my father was first generation born in this country about the turn of the century. And he had a funny attitude about spare the rod and spoil the child and beat the daylights out of me. And I used to lay in bed dreaming of the day I could grow up and beat him up. It hurt. And he really intended to have it hurt. I guess. Well, he quit. And he started reasoning with me. And that was good. So you hear that the son will always do what the father did. My son came along. And I did the same thing the first time and left him in the chair and walked down in the orchard. And I said, "That's the last one. He's not going to hate me at night laying in bed like I did my father." Of course, my father quit. I loved the man. Believe me. I had an eighth grade parent, so you understand I want to bring different phases in. I had an eighth grade parent sitting with me, and we were talking about his son. And he said, "I'm going to go home and whip that boy." All the sirens were off in my head. And I stated to him, "I may be overstepping my bounds, sir, but it's too late to whip your son. It's too late." I think it was 2 months later, the mother came in and she said, "Thank you very much. We don't have weapons in our house anymore." It paid off. The paddle... we were allowed to use paddle in the beginning. I might use it once, the beginning of the year. I want you to understand this. I always had a problem with it. First of all, if you hit the child too light, he's going to laugh at you. If you hit him too hard, you can hurt him. And I didn't like that, and I very seldom used it. And finally, I did away with it. I had other means of doing it. But I did ask over in the middle school, where Jeff was at, running to me at the middle school at that time in Halsey, not at this particular time we had stopped. And I asked the class, how many of you people would act up if you knew you went down to the principal's office and got a shot? Meaning, paddle once. You know how many hands went up? Not one. I did something else, and I took up push-ups. And this was easier. You can overdo push-ups. Girls and boys got the same treatment. In my class, girls did much less than boys. But in fairness to everybody, give them equal opportunity. One girl told me, "I have a dress on, and I can't do that." I said, "Oh, yes. You go in the back of that room, get over in an aisle where I can't see you, put your feet up against the wall, and all the boys are going to watch me." And she did her 10 push-ups. However she did them, I don't know if she did girls or boys, whatever. Some girl counted them for me. parents came in and said they feel relieved that they're all treated equal in here. I did something else probably that would bother some people, holding books. Now, they always tell the story that they had the big dictionary that thick. We had little books. And I'm going to come back to two people. One was at the Oregon Imaging Center when I took a person that had cancer in to be checked. I saw this fellow walk by me, and he walked over into the building, came out. He walked over and he said, "May I introduce you to my son, Mr. Carlson?" I thought, this is strange. I said, "Okay." So I stood up. He said, "This is the man we all talk about when we get together. This is the man that refused to let you fail. If you didn't want to do the work, he gave you the books, and you got the message." I really didn't have to use that. After the second year, it was a thing of the past because the people responded. I also ran into two young ladies just before Thanksgiving last year, and they were in the building over when we were in a six-year high school. And they told me they never came to class without their homework. They avoided any problems. They didn't want to have them. Now, you can say another one, late to class. I used that very effectively. You sang for 15 seconds up in front of the room. Now, you can say, well, that child may be embarrassed. But I explained to him why. Someday, you're going out into the working world. And you're really going to be embarrassed if you come late there. They fire you, and you'll go home. So I'm going to get you in the habit now of doing the right thing. And Mr. Smith, who is a... I think you had Mr. Smith also, a PE teacher, he asked a question, is there any class you're never late for? We're never late for Mr. Carlson's class, you have to sing. Now, there's one thing you have to be careful, too. You may have a child that freezes, and I'll tell you what they almost all sang. Old MacDonald had a farm because they couldn't think of anything else. They just... But anyways, if I had a child that started, I could see some actions, maybe that he was going to break down. I helped him. You know, there's nothing worse than embarrassment. And you have to be very careful to help them through it. I guess I had some other things. I broke up fights. Usually in junior high, it's easy. You just accuse them of having a little romance. You got a little romance going on here, boys? They break it up very quickly. You don't have problems. You've got to use this up here. And I can honestly say I've taken guns away from people, not in school, in other walks of life. And I've been confronted in construction in Chicago with other walks of life. So you have to do the right thing at the right time. You try, and you have to act quickly. Never corner a child. You've got to let a child save face. If you've got a child that you've caught doing something, sometimes it might be best to let them go home that night and decide on the punishment that they want to administer to you, for you to administer to them. And sometimes that helps. I think that saves the child the opportunity. We've only got 14 more people. No, I'm joking on that.
We actually have another group coming in.
Yes, I realize, and I'm going to take this out.
I'll take the paddle out, Mr. Chair.
Let them draw. Now, here's something not many teachers have guts enough to do, and I hesitated when I... We had some memory tests, and I said, when you're through, if you can't get up to me to have your test corrected, draw a picture on the back of your test of the most handsomest teacher you have in this room. Some never touched it. Some tried to really draw me. And you know what some of them did, don't you? They made me look terrible. And the parents came in, and they said, how can you stand that? And I said, because I'm the one that's permitting the students to do it. Some of them got rid of their animosity, maybe. I had the other one busy doing that while the rest of the people I was working with them. And another one is, years ago when I was a boy in Roseburg High School, they kicked you out of school, you were through. Today I want to admire the state that they cannot kick people out of school normally longer than a semester. And I think this is true. But the paddle probably is, they said, might pay to get a shot once in a blue moon, but only by a principal or assistant principal. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just one closing remark on my part. We have a number of amendments that have been drafted, and we'll be able to certainly go through those later on. And I might say that last night I made it a point to rent the movie and watch called Lean on Me, the story of Joe Clark. We took Eastside High School back in Philadelphia and took an extraordinarily difficult, horrible situation and turned around with tough love and great strict discipline and thinking outside the box and made a true difference in people's lives. And I have to tell you that Coach Carlson is one of three teachers in my life that made an extraordinarily positive impact upon me. It was because he used those same kind of methods. He was tough, but he was fair, and he got results. And that's why we need to help with this kind of legislation to allow teachers to have that kind of flexibility, allow them to be tough but fair, and keep kids and classrooms safe. Thank you.
Okay, we will bring this bill back. I apologize, we've got another committee that wants to get into this room. Normally it's open, so hopefully we'll all be able to return, and we'll bring this back as soon as we can. We'll close the public hearing on 2828, and we're just...